Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Britt Edelin, and today I have with me, speaking about his book, Richard Kearney, a professor of philosophy at Boston College, who is the author of numerous books, both critical books on contemporary philosophy and culture, as well as novels and poetry. Welcome to the network, the podcast today, Richard.
Thank you. Welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. And today we are talking about your new book. It's called Touch, Recovering Our Most Vital Sense. And it's out through Columbia University Press. It was published earlier this year. It was a really interesting read, and I'm excited to talk to you about it today.
Good.
So before we get more into the theoretical and the theoretical questions that the book raises, I want to ask, you know, what are your origins, both more broadly, philosophically or culturally, and then what brought you to writing this book?
Well, I'm Irish, born in Southern Ireland in the 1950s, grew up in a pretty conservative, you know, sort of Catholic nationalist culture. Where I would say touch was not, you know, a vital ingredient of everyday living. Although I came from personally a medical family where touch was important and a very affectionate family. But Ireland would have experienced, you know, Puritanism, both Protestant Puritanism and Catholic Jansenism, as it was called, which was, you know, Victorian, but sort of carried over into the 20th century. So I grew up in a culture where, unlike, say, the French or the Italians, where you know, tactile relations are very much part of everyday living. In Ireland, it wasn't so much the case. And also, I was aware that in the north of the country, in the 60s and 70s, there was a war going on, a war of religions. And this made me appreciate in many respects the importance, ultimately, of the handshake. That, you know, violence is one form of touch, which you know, causes pain and torture and death. But there's another kind of touch, which is that of the handshake. And the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, between Ireland and Britain, and the two communities in Ireland, which was signed in 1998, was sealed with the handshake, where the old enemies came together. And in a gesture of touch, open hand to open hand, they made peace. And that did affect me very much. You know, when John Hume won the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, shook hands with the terrorists and shook hands with the unionists. These were very, very significant moments. Civilization, you know, begins with the handshake, where two people throw aside their weapons and extend open palms to each other in an act of trust. And so, you know, we need to renew that act of civilization after periods of war and conflict and violence. And this is true of Northern Ireland. It's true of South Africa, the famous handshake between Mandela and de Klerk. It was true in the Middle East between Begin and Sadat, and so on and so forth. So the importance of the handshake was very, very, very vivid for me because of my experience in Ireland.
That's a really interesting story, and really interesting in that it bridges the personal and the political. If we can come up with a divide between those, that's might be up for debate. And I wanna talk about touch, obviously. And before we get into the first chapter of your text, I'd like to talk about how it needs to be recovered. So the fact that it's titled Recovering Our Most Vital Sense implies that it's lost in some way. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how it's lost, what led to the decline of touch, and perhaps was there an originary moment when touch might have been the most important, that you do talk about this, like in ancient Aristotelian thought?
Sure. I mean, I think touch has always been the most important from the beginning of time and still is, but I think our culture has diminished its our understanding of its importance. And I would say three things about this. I would say Platonism, I would say digitalization, contemporary digitalization in our current world, and I would say the COVID pandemic have all in a way marginalized touch in different ways. So let me say a quick word about each of the three. Plato, when he defines what a human is, anthropos is the Greek word for the human. And in one of his dialogues, he says the anthropos is, and this is what the word means, the one who stands up, the one who raises him or herself up from the earth and reaches towards the stars, looks up. It's the one who looks upwards. And in that process of looking upwards towards the ideas and away from the earth, touch was sidelined and considered secondary, considered even to some extent threatening for Plato, because the optocentric world, the centrality of the eye, be it the physical eye or the eye of the mind, is that which looks towards the light, towards the sun, a source of light, and towards the transcendental ideas. So with Plato and Platonism, you get a downgrading of the importance of touch, which is considered to be too immediate, too close to our animal sort of quadruped existence on the earth, and this privileging of sight, which gives us a distance and a control vis-a-vis our others and our environment, and lets us live in a more mental, conceptual, cognitive world. Secondly, I would point to the digital world. I mean, it's ironic that the word digital means finger or fingerprint, which is our identity, as we know, in so many, you know, passing through, you know, security controls and so on. But the digital is also our digital screen, that, you know, our touch screen, which enables us to enter into a virtual world, a disembodied world of hyperconnectivity, but at a disincarnate, or what I call an excarnate level. Now, this is very important in terms of our ability to have freedom in our relations with others. We couldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't for digital media. So we know all the advantages, but we've also lost something in the process, and that is the sense of presence and proximity, which is so fundamental to human being. And COVID has exacerbated that even more and dramatized it even more, because we now are forbidden to touch. The handshake is out. We have to socially distance. And even, you know, turning a doorknob, we have to make sure that, you know, we have a sanitizer with us. So with COVID, there obviously has been a prohibition on touch for health reasons. But I think it's also a wake-up call to us to realize that that is our most fundamental sense, that we have taken for granted and to some extent at our peril. So I'm not arguing for a, you know, sort of a jettisoning of our digital world and a return to some kind of primal immersion in animal nature. I'm saying we need both. We need the tactile relationship to others and the virtual, both of which come through the digital fingerprint and the digital screen.
So in this non-jettisoning of, I guess, the digital or the other senses, this brings me to another question, which brings, I guess, the part of the COVID era that is, how can we touch with while maintaining social distance. When I was reading this, I was thinking of Ellen Cixous, who has a little line in one of her texts about noli me tangere, with what Jesus says to Mary Magdalene, and she says that are there other ways of touching touching without touching, or without touching being touched? How can you do this with sight, with sound, with silence? And you bring this up in the first chapter, which is, it's titled Coming to Our Senses, and you talk about maybe the synesthesia or the synesthetics of touch. And I wonder if we could just go through those, because I think they're really important concepts of how we might navigate different types of touch and how touch can serve as a basis for the other senses.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Noli Me Tangere, do not touch me, as Jesus allegedly said to Mary Magdalene when she discovers him emerging from the tomb, doesn't actually mean do not touch me. It means do not grasp me. Mm. Do not hang on to me. Do not try to possess me. In fact, if you look at many of the portraits in religious art of that scene, you will see that Mary Magdalene is actually touching him. She is reaching out to him. But he is saying to her, I'm not an embodied risen person. He's saying, don't try to cling. So there's touching and touching. And I take Rigore's point that touching doesn't have to be this possessing of the other, the clinging, the grasping, but can be actually a way of touching without touching, or touching at a distance, if you will. And this is where, even with the COVID prohibition on touch, we can still have a certain kind of tangible, tactile relationship with others through the other senses, where touch is also at work. And this was the great insight of Aristotle in the De Anima, the first work of human psychology, when he said that touch is the most universal sense, because it's not just in touching where we have double sensation, i.e. we touch and are touched at the same time. If I take my hand and touch my other hand, I can experience touching and being touched at the same time. This is double sensation, reciprocity. But in the other senses, likewise, even though they seem to be unilateral, that you can see without being seen, hear without being heard, smell without being smelled, taste without being tasted, etc. The fact is that touch is at work universally and synesthetically throughout the other senses. For instance, when you look, and you're not just dominating the other with your look, but you're receiving the other, you're actually, receiving, you're open to the presence of the other. And even at a physiological level, light is touching your iris, your eye. Similarly with sound, if you really listen to another person, you receive the sounds into you and the vibrations, reach into the inner ear. In all of the senses, therefore, there is an element in which we do not experience the word truly unless we are touched by it. As our ordinary language says, I find that person very touching, or I was touched by what you said or what you did, or touché, meaning you got that one right. Or somebody is touched by fire, they have a genius, or they have the touch, as we say, of a good cook or a good healer or a good lover. Good artists, they have the touch. And this is a recognition in our vernacular language that touch is something that operates not just literally in physical touch, but throughout the other senses in our relations with other people. So yes, in that first chapter of the book, I go through the way in which what I call tactful sensation is at work, not just in tactful touch, where we are sensitive to the other instead of imposing, on the other tactilely, we are sensitive to where they're at. We receive their sensitivities through our sensibility. That's genuine tactful touch. Torture, rape, violation, molestation, they would all be forms, and Aristotle adds gluttony and brutishness. They're all forms of abusive touch, right? Where there isn't double sensation, there isn't reciprocity or mutuality. There's my imposing my will through my hand on the other. the stroke of a hand. But tactful touch, as I say, is this extraordinary sensitivity and sensibility to being touched by others. Now, and this, of course, is very important even in sexual pedagogy, you know, which is so controversial these days with, you know, the Me Too movement and people realizing that abusive touch has done so much damage. So there is a need for a new art, a new philosophy, a new pedagogy of touch, I do believe, to get back in touch with our senses. But we have tactful taste also, which is having good taste, you know, and connoisseurs of food or of wine know what tasting can really mean. And you know, where the gourmand becomes the gourmet, where we really attend to flavors. And this is true of anything, just appreciating some food that somebody gives you, appreciating where it comes from and who it comes from. So that I call tactful taste, I call savvy. And it's also a word we use for a certain way of knowing things. You know, it's sort of a fundamental, tactile, primal way of knowing, to have savvy, which is very often precognitive or preconceptual. Then, and indeed our word savvy comes from savourer, you know, the Latin word, savourer in Romance language is to savour. Which in turn comes from sapientia, sapere, to taste. Sapientia, the word for wisdom, is actually a question of tasting truth. Before we ever know truth, we taste truth. And then I won't spend too long on it now, and we can go back to it if you wish, but in the other senses, I say, for example, that a tactful seeing or sight is insight into the heart of things, where you see, as Seamus Heaney says, you know, seeing into the heart of things, not just our own, you know, categories and prejudices and presuppositions that we impose on things, but actually seeing into the heart of things is insight. That's tactful, where we're touched by things as we see them. Merleau-Ponty, the philosopher, has a beautiful description of the painter Cézanne, who's painting Le Mont Saint-Victoire in the south of France, and the forests, and he says, I had the impression as I was painting the trees that the trees were painting themselves through me, that as I was seeing them, they were seeing me. And that reciprocity makes for real, you know, aesthetic insight. Then at the level of, so there's savvy, there's insight. At the level of hearing, it would be resonance, to let something resonate, right, in you. Something outside of you to resonate inside you, to resonate with someone or something outside of yourself. That is tactful hearing. And I think, have I covered all the senses? I think I have. If I've left one out, let me know.
Sight.
Inside, savvy.
Flair,
there you go.
We have to have
okay.
Smell.
I missed flair, smell. And there you have it. You know, something we very often can learn from the animals. We talk about an animal flair, but when somebody has a flair for something, it is that sense of being able to scent, you know, the essence of something. And, you know, parfumerie as an art in aromas and appreciating aromas, obviously, is a very refined, cultivated form of sensation. But we have flair at every level, you know, right down from, you know, the most refined perfume to the basic animal ephemerons, you know, that we pick up and from other people and so on. So we're always scenting our way in being. You know, as one famous psychoanalyst put it, all comes down to smell in the end. And there were forms of, you know, healing, going right back to Asclepius, that were very related to scent. The healer would be able to smell health and illness. And you know, that sort of flair for healing was very, very fundamental, and is, I think, something we've almost lost, but perhaps it's coming back again. You know, with COVID, one of the first things to go was scent, and that's very interesting. It's one of our sort of basic animal ways of being connected to the world in a good sense. So just as we've been deprived of touch through COVID, when we actually are infected with the virus, we lose touch and taste, which were, you know, our first two tactful sensations as we made our way in the world with others.
Yeah, I think that's such a good insight, especially with, there were lots of like New York Times or Atlantic articles interviewing people who had lost their sense of taste or smell. And I think it was something that, you know, a lot of people just thought that was a symptom. And it was like, oh, that's not that bad. Like obviously not being able to breathe or needing to be hooked up to a machine, that was a horrible cause of or effect of COVID. But I think what people didn't realize was how much we depend on our senses, and what happens when just one or two of them are taken away, and how that dislocates you from the world.
Mm. Well, even when we say, you know, my sense of taste has left me, you know, I have no taste for things anymore. You know, our language actually, and here I have great respect for ordinary language philosophers, our language has a lot to tell us, our everyday language. And even just taking those ordinary vernacular words like taste and savvy and so on, have a taste for something, have a flair for something. We do say those things, even though our intellectual culture since Plato, which kind of won the battle with Aristotle. Aristotle said, touch is the most fundamental sense because it's in all the senses. And it's that which exposes us in our most vulnerable, fragile being to newness, to otherness, to novelty, right? We're most sensitive when we're most tactile. We're most sensible. It goes right across the board. But Plato won out with his optocentric prejudice, that it's actually sight which dominates the other senses that enables us to be an upright anthropos. And I think, you know, with the whole questioning of what we're losing, both in the digital age and in the pandemic age, I think we're recovering. It's a wake-up call to recover our fundamental senses, which are there, but which, as I say, we neglect or we take for granted.
So I want to get back to the philosophies of touch that you're talking about, that you began with Aristotle and we talked about Plato. But something that I was really interested in was your discussion of flesh. And I think this is something that you've talked about in other texts that you've written. So can you give us an idea of how, I think, so we've just been talking about how touch is not necessarily only tied to like touching things physically. I don't know. Now we've deconstructed the word touch and everything can be touched, but touching things in the ordinary sense, how is that related to flesh? And what does the fleshliness of, I guess, being human have to do with this importance of touch?
Well, flesh is our embodiment. It's our living presence in the world. We have two kind of bodies. Now, I'm taking this from contemporary, you know, from modern phenomenology, Husserl and so on. I won't get technical, Merleau-Ponty, Rigoret. But we have two kinds of body. We have the objective body, which in German was Körper. Our word corpse would come from that. And that's the body as viewed objectively, empirically, you know, scientifically, or in a laboratory. The objectified body, as opposed to the lived body, which is not just an objective body, but also a subjective or intersubjective body. And that's our being in the world with others is in terms of our embodiment, our lived body, right? Which is out there and in here at the same time. And there we are not separate, isolated, atomic, discrete beings, which somehow have to figure out how we get into contact with other people. You know, how do our bodies translate into mental ideas, the whole mind-body problem. That's an invention of philosophers, Plato and the idealists and the rationalists. But actually, as phenomenology shows, once you get back to the things themselves, to the lived body, to our incarnate beings in the flesh, you realize that we are interconnected from the word go. We are not originally separate beings. We separate out subsequently and become egos and autonomous self-governing egos, if you will. But that is a fiction. I mean, the Buddhists are right about that. There is actually no substantial, independent, autonomous, sovereign identity. Sartre was wrong. The Buddhists were right. Sartre and the Cartesians. And I would say Plato. They were all wrong on that one. So it's very important, I think, to realize that that flesh is what makes us human. And it's not the body versus the mind. It's the body as mind and the mind as body. You know, as Merleau-Ponty puts it, we are body subjects. And he has a hyphen between body and subject. So that seems to me very important. Aristotle already recognized that flesh, what in the Greek sarx, S-A-R-X, was not an organ, was not simply an organ, but was a medium, metaxu. And what he meant by that is we've got lots of organs, you know, livers and kidneys and heart and, you know, what have you, spleens. But flesh is not an organ that can be located anywhere in the body. Flesh is all of us. It's what we are as live flesh. And when you consider that skin, which is the epidermal manifestation of flesh, is for most adults 2 square meters. You know, it's the largest organ we have, which kind of allows us to be vulnerable, sensible, sensitive, attentive to the world and to others. Now, we cover ourselves up with clothes, with hair, and with our prejudices and our categories and our, you know, self-defense mechanisms. But ultimately, in the flesh, we are vulnerable beings. We are born naked in the flesh. We die naked in the flesh. And in between, we spend a lot of our times fleeing the flesh because we're afraid of the vulnerability. We're afraid of the exposure to otherness, to novelty, to surprise, to shock. But that's where growth comes. Growth comes from the flesh being exposed to the other. And I think, you know, contemporary phenomenology has done a lot to bring back our awareness that we are first and foremost incarnate beings in the world with others.
That makes me think of, you are probably familiar with Simone Weil's Gravity and Grace. In the chapter titled Metaxu, she talks about how she has the scenario of two prisoners who are separated by a wall, and that even though it's a separation, they can knock on it and communicate with each other. And she says every separation is a connection. And I'm thinking of flesh maybe as something not necessarily that's just what separates us from the world, but it actually is what connects us to the world. It's what allows access. And I think that goes along with what you're saying and how touch, maybe in recovering touch, we have to remember we are not like the neoliberal atomized subject. And I think this is something that COVID really has brought out, that we depend so much on each other. And I think touch can be a way of thinking about that, of how, like I'm always touching something. I'm touching my desk. I'm touching the air. Even when I'm not touching another person, there are other ways of reaching out across the earth or through time or through space. Like there's no way to not touch. And I think that's
And we are actually touched by the stars, you know, even physiologically, you know, it's not just a metaphysical or astrological or astronomical observation. It's just a scientific fact that the light vibrations touch us. And moon, you know, the life of the moon touches us in all sorts of ways, menstrual cycles, but also moods and, you know, equinoxes touch us. That we are connected. What flesh reminds us of and touch reminds us of is that we are in touch with the world, even when we deny it, even when we flee it. We are in touch with the world and we are affected by the world. We are not just pure self-choosing subjects who are thrown into the world of facticity. We are immersed in the world as we were immersed in an element like air and fire and earth and water. We are elemental beings. And one of the important things, I think, about the recovery of touch philosophically and culturally now, you know, with this wake-up call with the pandemic, as we become more aware of how important touch is to us, now that we've lost it or been deprived of it, as Joni Mitchell used to sing, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. Mm-hmm. I think this is also a wake-up call to the environment, to the ethics of the environment and ecology, you know, the climate crisis, that this is a matter of life and death. And we are beholden to the earth. We are beings that are incarnate in the earth. And the new awareness that you find, particularly in the younger generation, in terms of sort of an eco-ethics and an eco-sensibility vis-a-vis trees and water and rivers and you know, nature and animals and plants, this is a huge conscientization at a planetary level that seems to me absolutely fundamental. And coming back to what you said about touch, I think of, you know, the story you mentioned, Simone Weil. I think of, you know, the Count of Monte Cristo, who's imprisoned in the Chateau d'If off the south coast of France, and he hears tapping on the wall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually he realizes somebody in another cell, and they finally meet. And it's one of the most beautiful scenes in the film. But in a way, it's a metaphor for our lives, that we have ended up in separate cells, and there's knocking going on, but are we aware of it? And if we are, then we can finally break through again to those others that are there, but we've constructed these walls between us, you know, politically, culturally, and so on. And I would just add, in terms of the importance of touch, that touch is always on. You know, you can close your eyes and not see, you can close your ears and not hear, but you can't turn off touch. If you turn off touch, you are dead, right? Even when you're asleep, the body is tactile and tangible. It's only at the moment of death that you lose touch. And that's why, you know, the old test was you'd cut the body and, you know, if the person feels nothing, they're gone. The only two parts of our body, of our entire body, that are not tactile or tangible are our nails and our hair. And that's why if you go into a beauty salon and you see people having their hair cut or their nails cut, you don't find them screaming because they're not feeling it. But the rest of our body, all 2 square meters of it for the average adult, is always on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So you bring up that they wouldn't be screaming, and I think this idea of pain is where I want to go to next, because you spend a considerable amount of time talking about healing. And I think this is part of the recovering. It might not be this type of like recovering, getting back to touching, but it's healing is recovery. And I think I want to ask about how is touch related to healing, and what are you trying to bring out with this, and how maybe we need a type of healing that's based on touch, or get back to a more originary type of healing? Mm-hmm.
Well, you look at the wisdom traditions. In all of them, you will find that healing comes through touch. I mean, in the Abrahamic tradition, it's very obvious. You know, in the Jewish, Christian, Islamic traditions of healing, you find the laying on of hands is absolutely, you know, pivotal. You find it in the Greek tradition too. I mean, I won't go into the Eastern traditions now. They're not my particular area of competence, although I'm very interested in the importance of touch in Hinduism and Buddhism. But, you know, when the Buddha looks for wisdom, what does he do? His hand reaches down to the ground. And you will find in, you know, Buddhist practices, this idea of grounding and being in touch with your breathing, you know, and the yoga tradition is very much coming back into touch with the body. But in the Western Greek tradition of healing, you had two basic movements, inaugural movements. You had Hippocrates, hence our Hippocratic tradition, which we have to this day, the Hippocratic Oath, which all healers and doctors commit to. And you have the other tradition is the Asclepian from Asclepius. And it seems to me both are necessary, but in our Western modern culture, we've lost the Asclepian, although I think we're trying to get it back again now, and we have let the Hippocratic reign. Now, the Hippocratic basically operates according to a model of supervision, vision, supervision, optocentric control, intervention, management of pain and curing. That's our medical model, more or less, today, even imaging technologies, x-rays and so on, indispensable. Who wants to do without that? Nobody. But the level of the tactile, you know, the what was called the old bedside manner is reduced to a minimum. For insurance reasons, you know, all sort of medical consultations have to be kept to a minimum. Half of the time, the doctor, you know, is not looking at you or taking your hand or your pulse, but is actually spending more time looking at the computer screen where all your records are coming up. And that's just the way it is. Digital, you know, medicine has become e-medicine and digital medicine more and more. Excuse me. But the Asclepian, going back to Asclepius, was another way of healing that was supplementary and complementary, and I would argue even more fundamental, and that was carried out synesthetically. It operated through touch, laying of hands, music, movement, the ingestion of herbs, the incubation of the body in the earth, where it would be literally put to sleep for hours, days, even weeks sometimes, and, you know, kept alive with water and so on. But the idea was that you go back into the earth, particularly if you're suffering from a very profound illness, mental illness in particular. And then you would be visited by dreams very often, where Asclepius would appear, interestingly, in the form of an animal, a cock or a horse or a dog or a serpent. And that was also a sort of a return to the healing powers of the earth, to our animal nature. And it operated very much through touch. In fact, Asclepius was the disciple of Chiron, who was the first wounded healer. He himself was wounded in a hunt with boars and then subsequently in a battle. But instead of imposing injury on his enemy, or his opponent, he actually lived the wound in such a way that he healed others. So he was the wounded healer. And this was the paradox, which you even find in the, you know, in the scepter and the serpent on pharmacies and chemists, even to this day. The serpent was considered the pharmakon in Greek, who could poison you, but could also cure you. So the idea that in the wound, you can find the healing. And they even say in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis that it's, you know, trauma speaking to trauma. If somebody as a healer doesn't recognize and assume their own woundedness, they cannot really be sensitive or attentive or sensible when it comes to healing others. So the wounded healer in oneself speaks to the wounded healer in the other. And that's the Asclepian tradition. Which was very, very important and, you know, was theatrical. There are even theaters to this day, Epidaurus in Greece, which was devoted to Asclepius, and Asclepian rituals which, as I say, involve the whole body and were very incarnate and carnal as modes of healing, as opposed to, I repeat, the Hippocratic, which was very sort of top down, very cognitive. But as I say, we need both. And I think in our contemporary age, what people would sometimes call now alternative healing through herbs, through, you know, deep tissue massage, through yoga, through breathing, all of that coming back in touch with the body is very, even psychedelics, you know, a lot of the psilocybin healing that's going on now is coming back into the body in a way that, as I say, supplements Hippocratic healing.
So you bring up psychoanalysis, and I think I wanted to ask about that in the sense that your chapter on this type of healing and trauma begins with the question of psychoanalytic origins. And when we think of psychoanalysis, or maybe if people don't want to think of psychoanalysis, maybe of psychotherapy or something similar, we think of talking, we think of the mind, and I think the last thing, there's that thought of, if you know the story of Lacan touching the woman on the cheek for the Gestapo, so she was visited by the Gestapo in the mornings, and she mentioned she had a dream every morning at 5 a.m., and that's when the Gestapo would come, and she's French, so she says, Gestapo, and at that moment, Lacan gets up and touches her face, and it's a Gestapo, and he re-signifies that term. But that's like something that wouldn't happen today. And I mean, my therapist would never touch me in any way. I think that would be some kind of a break in the bond, or in maybe even like legal doctrines. I don't know. But how can we think about touch in these really mind-based therapies, or things that we think of as only belonging to, you know, maybe a Cartesian duality between body and mind that privileges the mind over the body?
Yeah. Well, you know, the beginnings of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis and trauma studies are very interesting, because Freud initially in the 1890s did believe in sort of a fundamental laying on of hands. And then, you know, after his studies of hysteria and so on, he became much more cerebral and the talking cure took over. Although ironically, in his first work on trauma, therapy, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he has a scene where he talks about his little grandson, Ernst, having a tantrum and crying hysterically when Ernst's mother leaves, Sophie Freud, who is Freud's daughter, and Ernst's mother. And the little boy plays with a spool of cotton, and he casts the spool away and he says, fort, gone. And then he pulls it back and he says, da. And Freud realizes that with these two words, he is gone back again. He is actually miming the coming and going of the mother and becoming sort of the master of his own destiny through this little illusory play. And that this alleviates the anxiety because he finds a symbolic substitute for the coming and going of the mother that as a, you know, 14-month-old child, he couldn't, or 18-month-old, I think he was, he couldn't figure out. So that transference of confusion and pain at the loss and departure of its mother, his mother, was his first little trauma that he dealt with by making up this game of words. But what Freud failed to realize at that point was that the boy is not just using two words, the shortest story ever told, fort da, gone back again. He's also playing with his hands. He's pushing the cotton spool away and then taking it back again and grasping it, letting it go, holding it, letting it go, holding it. And that, I think, is where psychoanalysis went wrong. It separated the talking cure from the touching cure, so to speak. And it became very, very cognitive. Now, with contemporary trauma studies, this is changing radically. I mean, one of the authors I cite at great length in the touch book is van der Kalk, his book, The Body Keeps the Score, where he shows that in trauma therapy, and he goes through Winnicott and, you know, the attachment theorists to show that our full carnal presence and co-presence in a healing situation is absolutely essential. That includes, you know, as well as medication, obviously, which is important, and as well as psychotherapeutic talk, which is important. Nobody's denying that. We also need more and more a full holistic approach to the body and not just the mind. You can't cure the mind without also and at the same time curing the body, because we are incarnate embodied beings. And that's where things like breathing, rapid eye movement, massage, even animal therapy with horses, dolphins, dogs, for some autistic kids have proved to be very, very important. So this whole dimension of touch and being in touch, even you can be present with somebody sitting in a seat opposite you, that is actually very tangible. It doesn't literally mean, you know, putting your hand on the cheek, or as Merleau-Ponty describes in Phenomenology of Perception, Binswanger, the famous existential psychotherapist, who at one point stood up, walked over, and placed his hand on the throat of his patient as the patient was suffering a spasm, the patient was aphasic, and just that touch did something that released the spasm and healed the trauma. Now, you have to know the right moment for that. But coming back to your point that your therapist would never, ever dream of touching you. Well, when I suffered from a very bad depression once, I had a therapist in Paris. Every session we had began with her shaking my hand. And every session ended with her hugging me. Now, you may say, well, that's very Gallic and very, you know, Latinate. That's what Latins do. But maybe Binswanger happens to be German, you know, not Gallic. And I think more and more people are realizing, whether it's literally touch, the handshake to begin or end, or just being present to somebody in a tangible way. So that, for example, if they weep, you don't just sit back and wait for the signifier to pop up verbally, linguistically. You actually, you know, reach out and put a hand on their shoulder or their arm, or you give them a Kleenex, or, you know, you reassure them in some way. And so again, it's not a literalism of touch. It's being tangible, being tangibly present. Whereas the old psychoanalytic model, the Freudian model, you know, of the patient not looking at the analysand or the analyst, and lying down, you know, with eyes closed, where there was only the words being heard. And now I accept that can help with free association at a linguistic level and an unconscious level, but it deprives the healing relationship of all the asclepian moments that it seems to me are equally important. Talk alone is not enough. It's absolutely essential. As I would say, for many forms of clinical depression, medication is essential. But we also need the art of healing touch, the bedside manner, as it used to be called.
So with the idea of touch as being just essential to healing, I want to move into your last chapter, or not the last chapter, the fifth chapter on reclaiming touch in the age of excarnation. So we've talked a little bit about you know, the digital age as being an age in which we are disembodied or embodied somewhere else, or we're excarnate. And you write that we are witnessing a shift in our relation to the body. Can you say a little more about, I think, this relation to the shift in how we relate to the body? And I'm thinking particularly of how it relates to your epigram, which is technology connects us but does not bring nearness. So how is touch related to nearness, and how is the digital age doing something to destroy that type of nearness? And like maybe how you're perceiving recovery without, you know, just saying like, just get rid of technology. Technology's bad. I don't think anybody's going to say that anymore. But how do we recover it with alongside technology?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a both and. I mean, as you say, nobody wants to or should want to get rid of technology. You know, it's like getting rid of penicillin, you know, or electricity, or locomotion. It just doesn't make sense. The gains are massive, thanks to, you know, the digital world. But attendant upon digital connectivity is the danger of hyperconnectivity, where we are so instantaneously plugged into so many multiple sources that we're not actually attending to any single one. And it's a phenomenon that studies have showed that with that hyperconnectivity comes also chronic loneliness, particularly in the Z generation and the millennials, and suffer from a huge sense of isolation. So you can have all the social media in the world and as many Facebook friends in the world, but some aspect of human connection is lost in the hyperconnectivity. The digital fingerprint gets, as it were, subsumed into the digital code. So what we need is both a deeper deployment and more intelligent, sensitive deployment of digital technology, and at the same time, a recovery of our primal sensitivity as beings in the world, incarnate in the world. And I think our digital culture, in a way, is teaching us, you know, this lesson in many respects. In that, I think, fifth chapter of the book, I cite many TV series, you know, Westworld, or movies like Ex Machina or Her, where you have these androids and cyborgs being created, sort of a contemporary version of the Frankenstein story, and these sort of so-called ideal beings. But the one thing that's always missing, you will find in gaming, in the movies, in the TV series, cable series, is touch, is the tactile relationship. You'll see it again and again, beautifully described in Her, where, you know, the protagonist falls in love with an operating system, but it's a pure sign, it's a pure voice, and what he's missing is the incarnate contact with the physical other, and it explores how that is possible and impossible. The same for Ex Machina. I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with these scenes, and increasingly, you know, Death Stranding and other games with, you know, millions of viewers are pointing to this need to reconnect. So it's kind of the computer saying to us, don't forget that you're an embodied being as well as a disembodied one, that you're a real person as well as a virtual person. And we are both. So I think the growing awareness also, as I said earlier, of the climate, of the environment, of the elements in which we live and breathe, and the urgency to work together in solidarity around that, particularly for the young generation. I think it was UNESCO did a global report asking, you know, millions of people, all five continents under the age of 40, what is the most important pressing moral problem of our time? The answer, 80%, was the environment, the planet. And that's getting back into touch with our lived interspecies coexistence with other human beings and other beings, you know, animal and mineral and vegetable. So that's where I would be very hopeful. And we can be, again, you know, conscientized, our awareness can be raised by digital communications. What's going on in the Amazon, you know, what's going on in the floods in Sydney as we speak, what's going on in the fires in, you know, California. We know that thanks to digital communications. So we need to be connected to what's going on in the world to be aware. But then we need to actually, you know, go into the streets and do something about it. And, you know, as E.M. Foster says, only connect. And the connection is both digital as code and communications, but also digital as the fingerprint, the handshake. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking when I was reading this about the touch screen and how those are so ubiquitous, I think it's Eve Sedgwick who has, she writes on texture because she was an artist working with like knit and I don't know, like craft. But she comes up with the difference between texture with 1x and texture with 2x. And part of that difference is like feeling things with like different textures on something, and how a lot of our world today is smooth. And I was thinking about how, like, when you touch your phone and then I touch my computer and then I touch like the cover of a book, I think how many things I touch during my day that has no texture and almost feels like I'm trying to touch nothing. I was thinking about that. I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but like just extemporaneous, but I was thinking about how maybe there's almost a lack of touching even within touching. Like my phone tries to make it so that it seems like I just barely have to tap my screen and it comes up with something, and there's almost something anxious about like if I have to touch too hard, I know something's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, we have maybe become more insensitive to the textuality of touch, or arguably and paradoxically more sensitive potentially. I mean, you know, what you're describing there actually is an awareness of the differences and maybe the absences of touch. I mean, the very observation that in a slight tip of your finger, of your digital finger, you can enter into a global network of communication, right? The slightest touch can bring. So it's a touch screen that warrants or that allows the exit from touch. But that very conundrum, that very paradox, gets you to think about touch. What is touch such that a single touch can exit from touch? And that's, I think, half the battle, is just getting people to not take it for granted, not to take touch for granted, or not to take the lack of touch for granted, but to question it. And that's what philosophy is. It's raising the question of touch. That is half the battle. And I think if the pandemic, if the digitalization of our experience at so many levels, not just communications, which we've been talking about, or popular culture, or art, but at all levels, banking, schooling, sports, even esports, you know, practically every domain of our existence because of the pandemic has been at least in part replaced by some e-network of communications. So we're aware of the richness of digital technology, but also of what is lost in translation. And something is lost in translation. And that's why people can Zoom with their loved ones in hospital as they die, or be on the iPhone with them. And that's very important. But they all know, those dying and the loved ones who want to be with them, that what they are really missing is that ultimate final parting touch. And that's fundamental to people. I don't know of one case. It'd be very hard to find a case where the dying person or the loved one was to say, you know, the family member, you know, it was actually better online. Who needs to go into that messy hospital and into the wards and, you know, get in the way of the nurses? No, it's fine. This is as good. No, everybody felt the lack of it. And as I think I mentioned earlier, you know, studies of children, you know, infant touch. When children are born, they need to be touched. If they are held and touched and nourished, they thrive and flourish. If not, as in, for example, the case of the orphans in Ceausescu's, you know, Romanian regime, the infant mortality, they died. They literally withered and died. I think the infant mortality rate was 60% in the first year. Children that are not touched, and those who survived with huge physical and psychic impairments. So, you know, the facts are there medically and clinically and statistically to remind us that at the beginning of life and the end of life, touch is absolutely indispensable, and in between, likewise, however much we may take it for granted.
Yeah, what you were just talking about with the pandemic, it reminded me, I was talking with maybe my mom like a few months ago about how much, like she was like, I don't know, when was the last time you touched someone? And I didn't, I was like, a very long time ago. But I mentioned like, I also don't think I've accidentally touched anyone in a very long time. Like, I said something like, oh my gosh, I would give anything to like bump into someone at the store. And I think something that this pandemic has done has made us almost hyper aware of our bodies and like the anxiety of touch, even though, you know, like, I don't think if I like just like bump shoulders with someone, I'm going to get COVID, but there's a fear of the what if. And I think that's really come out in the last year.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. If you watch a child enter a room, a young child, right, a toddler, the first thing they'll do is to figure out where they are by touching things. First thing, they reach out to touch. And, you know, one of the great paintings of Genesis by Michelangelo is Yahweh and Adam reaching out to touch. Right? In the beginning is touch. And the sensitivity of touch, the very gap between the two fingers, is still a tangible, tactile relationship of the importance of touch as they reach out to touch. Reaching out to touch is as important as actually touching. So you're wanting to kind of bump accidentally into people is itself an expression of a touch hunger, which has become such a feature of our pandemic digital age. So I think that's very important.
Well, I have one final question. And I think that I hope that it's touch is still something you're working on in the future, because this was such a provocative book. And I think it'll come out more as we enter a post. I don't think we'll ever be truly post COVID. I think it's here with us to stay. But as we are maybe able to touch a little bit more, what are you thinking about going into the future? Either related to this or unrelated, do you have anything in the pipeline already or thoughts coalescing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very struck by the advances now being made in sort of digital experiments with touch, because I end the book with a plea for the conjoining, right, of both worlds, our virtual digital world and our carnal digital world. And I think to be fully human, we need both. But I was very, very taken by an experiment that one of my colleagues here in Boston, Kate Bisbee, who works in digital technology, told me about, which is a haptic vest that has now been invented, where you can have headgear that gives you, you know, the sensation of being a tree and you're looking out over the forest and you hear the noises of the winds and the birds and the insects. And then with this vest, you actually experience tangibly the swaying of the leaves and branches. And it's very interesting for me that, you know, if touch is our first sense in the womb and the last to leave us at death, the need in digital technology to find some way of reconnecting with touch, you know, through this haptic technology, as it's called, is the last one to come. We've had digital sound, digital sight far earlier than we've had digital touch. But I think there's an interesting, maybe brave new world opening up, where we can try and bring the tactile closer to the digital and then the digital back in touch with the tactile. That's the paradox and that's the challenge, to bring them together.
Well, that sounds interesting. I hope you can do it. I hope someone can do it.
It won't be me, but it might be other, you know, brilliant artists and scientists and maybe even philosophers and psychologists, who knows.
Yeah, it's exciting to know that someone's working on it. I've not heard of that project, and I would love a haptic vest. I think it'd be very cool.
There you go.
I imagine it's very expensive, so maybe I won't for a while.
Maybe in 10 years' time, we'll all be going around with our haptic vest.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Well, I want to say thank you for coming onto the podcast and talking with us about your book. It was a very interesting conversation and has left me with a lot to think about.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Britt.
So once again, that was Richard Kearney, a professor of philosophy at Boston College. We were talking about his book, Touch, Recovering Our Most Vital Sense, which was out earlier from earlier this year from Columbia University Press. I'm Britt Edelin. I'm your host at the New Books Network on the New Books and Literary Studies channel. Thank you, and until next time.